Attention, attention all personnel. It's MASHcast.
Hello and welcome to MASHcast, the show that analyzes and celebrates episode by episode the greatest TV series of all time. MASH was shared on CBS from 1972 to 1983. Proud member of the Fine Water Podcast Network, I am your host, General Robert Iron Guts Kelly. And joining us this week in the VIP 10 are our attending physicians, Dr. Ange. Hi, Ange.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for inviting me in this very great episode of MASH. Can't wait to talk about it.
Oh, boy. And Dr. Chris Lewis.
Hi, Rob. I came for the jokes, but I'm staying for the end-to-end anastomosis chat. So, boy, is there a lot of medicine today.
once it became clear to me that this is something we're going to do every season where I'm going to have these two eminent physicians on, I immediately went to Lifetime, right? I immediately was like, ooh. And I can't wait to get to season 8 because, like, the most medically episode of MASH ever was coming for season 8. So I really, really been looking forward to this one. So, of course, you've both been on the show multiple times. So I'm going to get right to the plot description and then we will get right to this episode. So this is the 11th episode of season 8, Lifetime, originally aired November 26, 1979. Perfect for Thanksgiving. Written by Alan Alda and Dr. Walter D. Deschel, M.D. There is a name we haven't seen in the writing credits before. And directed by Alan Alda. Wounded arrive, and one of them is a young man named George. He has a severe injury to his aorta, so severe that Hawkeye has to reach into his chest right there on the chopper pad to pinch it off to stop the bleeding. As if that's not difficult enough, having the aorta pinched off this way is cutting off blood to George's spinal column. If that goes on for longer than 20 minutes, he'll end up paralyzed. As they load the young man onto a jeep headed for the OR, a small clock appears on the screen, keeping real time as it passes. BJ and Margaret help Hawkeye, and he asks Klinger to round up as much ice as possible, thinking that hypothermia might buy them some time. Another wounded soldier named Harold has a traumatic brain injury, and it's clear that he's going to die. While frustrated over not being able to help him, BJ gets the idea that perhaps, once Harold does die, they could take a piece of his aorta and give it to Hawkeye's patient. The only problem is, Harold could stay alive for hours. While Father Mulcahy makes a run to the chopper for some much-needed blood, he asks the Lord, if you're going to take him anyway, please take him quickly so we can save the other boy. After precious minutes go by, Hawkeye commits himself and removes the damaged part of George's aorta in the expectation that he's going to get a viable graft. Winchester questions this, but finally agrees when he sees for himself that George's aorta is so damaged it cannot be repaired. Eventually, the other young soldier, Harold, does die, and BJ gets the graft, running it into the OR immediately. Hawkeye puts it in, but of course it's not that easy. He wants to get blood pumping to the spinal cord, so he has to try and stitch it while the blood is coursing through it. We see some of that blood as it spurts up out of the chest cavity. When the surgery is over, they check their time. Unfortunately, they're 3.5 minutes over. Hawkeye is enraged, thinking they've all but certainly paralyzed the young man for life. BJ tries to offer some hope, suggesting that the hypothermia may have bought them some time. Later that day, in post-op, George starts to wake up. They yell in his ear, trying to get him to wake up. They uncover his feet and run a pencil along the bottom of them to see if he can move. After a few seconds, they see them move, proving the young man isn't paralyzed after all. Hawkeye, BJ, and Margaret squeal with glee, delighted. All their extraordinary efforts have paid off. All right, fellas. First question I want to ask both of you, just to kind of set the table a little bit, is I'm not going to ask if either one of you dealt with this situation, because I think we could, maybe you have, but have either one of you dealt with something where time was of this import? Like, it was literally beating down, like, got right now, that kind of thing. Has either one of you dealt with this level of pressure in cases in your life? So, Ange, let me start with you.
Well, you know, Rob, I'm in an emergency department and a tertiary care emergency department, which means that lots of specialized and complicated people come in. And so I will tell you that I have dealt with near brain herniation, which is what we're going to talk about later, where people have had to, like, show signs that things are happening and we need to get imaging and neurosurgery available and whisk to the operating room for sure. I've intubated people because we needed to sort of take control of their airway because of brain herniation that was sort of imminent. So for sure that. There are other things that we have specific clocks for. So there's something called testicular torsion, where if you are over 4 hours with the testicle torsed and not getting blood, it's not viable. And so like that has to rush to the operating room. There's ovarian torsion, where the ovary can twist the same way, where there are sort of time limits. And those people come into the emergency department often having been at home for a little bit of time, with like out realizing what's going on. So there have been things that come in that we're sort of like, this needs to go right away. I've dealt with traumatic brain injury, bleeding in the skull as well. Sometimes that we even try to tell the ambulance to go directly to the operating room. Don't even waste time in the emergency department. So the ER is a special place. I get, I'm in a pediatric emergency department, so I probably don't see all of the craziness that the adults do, but I'm also in a highly almost quaternary care center. So I see all of the really complicated things sort of funnel to me, and I have to sort of deal with.
Chris?
Yeah, I mean, Angie's in ED, so he's going to see a lot more than I have. But yeah, I mean, when I was training in hospital, then I was running cardiac arrests where the heart has stopped and blood is not flowing and time is muscle, time is brain, you know. So yes, absolutely. There was one occasion where I was on call in the middle of an accident and emergency department, and a call went out for the crash team, cardiac arrest in the pediatric outpatients department, which was not a very typical place to get a cardiac arrest. And I was stood in the middle of AE, said a very bad word very loudly and ran. Fortunately, it wasn't a child. It was somebody they just, you know, the porters were taking somebody back from X-ray when they'd had an arrest and they'd taken them to the nearest safe place. So it was good on them. But so I have done. And I would say, I would add to my credentials, although I am now these days a general practitioner, my very first job as a very junior doctor was doing vascular surgery. So my boss was doing aortic surgery once a week. We were doing fempop bypasses. So I have a certain, albeit a bit out of date, knowledge of vascular surgery. So this particular type of thing was what my boss was doing week in and week out. And I was clerking them in. I was getting them in preoperatively and doing all the bloods and making sure the ITU bed was booked in time and getting their echocardiogram sorted and all that kind of stuff. So, so I have seen a bit of this kind of surgery, albeit not in this theatre of war setting. I think that's a bit unkind to call North Wales a theatre of war.
I'm curious. One other thing I want to ask both of you before we get rolling here is, obviously, you have to be cool under pressure when you've got this kind of thing bearing down on you. Do you deal well with that kind of time pressure in your non-doctor lives? Like, are you good at just, and because the reason I'm asking this is like, and this is, I'm such a ninny about this, but I'm owning it, is like when I think I'm going to be late to a movie, I get so tense. I'm like, I'm ridiculous. Poor Kelly has to deal with me being such a jerk because I am, and so I'm always like, we have to leave because every theater that we go, we have to drive a long time to get there. I'm always like, let's leave an hour before we need to, because, and if we hit traffic, I'm like drumming my fingers on the thing and she can see it, and that's a movie, that's not life and death. So I'm wondering how have you guys trained yourself to not get that freaked out when it's, you know, and does it manifest itself in minor ways? Like, Andrew, are you in line to get your comic signed by somebody and like you're afraid they're going to leave before you get the book signed and you're like, okay, all right. I mean, like, you know, it's got to come out somewhere, right? For either one of you guys.
What's your time management like, Dr. Lewis? Feels like an appraisal question. I'm feeling a little on edge here.
Sorry, I didn't make this ahead, make sound like a performance review.
Oh, no. You know, it's funny. You know, that calmness under pressure when you're dealing with medical emergency is almost always about making sure that things are happening efficiently, right? So, like, there are going to be parts of this episode that I'm going to talk about how, like, that was an inefficient use of time. That was an efficient use of time, right? We're going to sort of, like, why was that delay happening? And you can't, like, you know, one of the things they'll say is, you know, you don't have to be the smartest person in the room running these things. You can say, like, I know what to do. You know, does anybody else have any ideas? You're supposed to say that. But you definitely have to be calm. And there definitely has to be one leader in those situations so that people aren't shouting things out and confusing everybody. And so what happens is I am so used to wanting all of that efficiency that when I see inefficiency in my regular life, like traffic, right, you know, I actually get very, right, I have no control over this. In the resuscitation room, I have some control. I have no control over traffic or the fact that in the middle of me waiting in line at Walt Simonson's table, he had to leave to go for a panel and I had to sit here for 40 more minutes, right? You know, so I tend to get a little bit more frustrated outside of work, I think mostly because things are a little bit less in my control and almost always about inefficiencies. This makes no sense to me that this is taking this long. Isn't your job supposed to be to get me my coffee in a rapid fashion, right? You know, so it's always good. Thank goodness that I have Anna with me, who's like, you know, what does it matter? And I'm like, I guess you're right. I will exhale. So that's my take.
I think there's the bit about prioritization, isn't there? Actually, you know, like you say, you know, I am somebody that likes to be on time. I am, you know, but that I think came from my parents who would do the same. So I was sort of trained to leave. You got to get there 25 minutes early if you want to get a decent seat kind of thing. But there is also but it's only a movie, you know, we see things that you kind of go, actually, this is worth prioritizing. I need to put this first. And I get upset if I've missed something that needed prioritizing, whereas I can be a little bit more, you know, chill about the rest.
Okay.
Keep calm and carry on.
You will never see me want to murder someone more than when I'm in the line at a concession stand at a movies and someone ahead of me doesn't know what they want once they get to the counter. I am. I hope you choke on your popcorn. How do you not know what you want? You've had time. There's only four options. Just pick something.
You know this is being recorded, right? You did just admit to when you might murder somebody.
I know.
Okay. Look, just checking. Okay.
Chris, I don't know if you're following current events. There's no laws here in America anymore. We can just do whatever. It's just the total chaos. So, okay. So this episode opens on the chopper pad with Hawkeye and BJ and Margaret and Klinger playing cards, something we've never seen them do before, which I like. I think it's very funny. It's, you know, that they sort of made this jerry-rigged this poker table because they obviously been given a heads up that the chopper is coming. Now, as we'll see in a moment, as you just talked about, Ange, it's an inefficient way to play poker. Because the minute the chopper lands, all of the material goes flying off the table, including all the money, which they will never get back because we see it just fly out in all directions. It's an incredibly dumb way to handle something, but it's okay. And I like that when Margaret, she says, not until the skids hit the dirt, Buster, three deuces. And they're all like, oh, how about that? Like, they're actually kind of celebrating that she won, which is cute. And you even hear Margaret say, Klinger, you know, make sure you get my money. So then we go over to the wounded soldier. The chopper pilot is played by an actor named J.J. Johnston. Great handle. Born in 1933, passed away in 2022. Ton of great movie credits for this guy. Fatal Attraction, JFK, The Spanish Prisoner, Mad Dog and Glory. I mean, again, quite a career for somebody who's got all of like two lines here in a MASH episode. So now we're getting the case. Hawkeye is talking about that the blood is pouring through the bandage, and BJ says, you got to get him to OR, and he says he's not going to make it to OR. I think he's got a lacerated aorta, and he says, you go in there, I can get a knife. I got a pocket knife. Let me have it. Now, this is the first – they don't talk about this part at all. They'll deal with it later. Is that great to have a pocket knife that's not been sterilized cutting into somebody's aorta?
No. What I like about the poker scene is they're really competitive with each other over what I'm not a poker player. They seem to have pretty lame hands, as far as I can tell. Is three deuces a good hand? It doesn't sound good. But the minute the skids hit.
But the deuces is obviously the lowest three you can have. Yeah.
But the minute they're on, the minute the patient arrives, they are a team. And I really like that contrast between this quite, it's good nature, but there's a little bit of an edge to their competitiveness, but they become a team, they become a unit really quickly. But I do kind of go a little less poker playing and a little more getting your equipment ready for the trauma that's about to arrive. I don't know about you, Ange. We've got our resus kit in a big bag, so wherever it is, we can just grab it and run. I'm sure you're the same. And you would have a pair of scissors to cut clothes open. You would have, we don't deal with that kind of trauma. You'd have all the equipment you need. So yeah, come on, a little bit less poker and a bit more getting ready for the patient. I'm surprised the chopper didn't radio ahead to say these are bad patients.
Yeah, it's true. As we go through this, I'm going to try to make analogies to my work, right? And so when an ambulance is arriving, they call ahead and say, "Hey, we are bringing in this patient," which allows us to prepare ahead of time. We've never really seen the chopper pad. It's up on a hill, relatively far away. It's a jeep ride to the OR.
Yeah.
So I'm with Chris. Like, I'm surprised there isn't, when there's a code blue in the hospital, there's this enormous, almost roll around luggage bag that we have that has all sorts of things in it that would allow you to do some immediate resuscitation on a patient that took the time wasted to get to the emergency department or to the ICU would be too long. And so the fact that he has to ask the chopper pilot, "Do you have anything?" and it's the chopper pilot's pocket knife makes me think, like, I don't like if thank God the chopper pilot had a pocket knife. If not, this guy's probably dead on the pad, right? So I
What
do think.
engine has that been in already? Yeah.
Yeah, and so, like, yeah, I was using it to cut my Slim Jim before, right? So, but then this is the thing, Rob, right? Is that it's always like, you have to make a lot of snap decisions when these things happen. I can either try to get him on a jeep and drive him to the OR and he'll probably die en route, or I can cut his chest open with a dirty pocket knife and shove my bare hand that was just dealing with dirt and cards and money
Money,
and
yeah,
just
dirty
shove it
money.
in, right? And just shove it in and hold vital organs. Right. Well, I'd rather deal with the repercussions of my dirty hand being in his chest and have him be alive than have him die and then say, like, maybe I should have shoved my dirty hand in his chest. But different people have different risk aversion. There certainly would probably, like, I doubt Winchester would do that, right? If we try to think about different medical styles. And in fact, we'll even see Margaret later on do something that I think is, like, a little bit ludicrous similarly, but we'll get there.
Okay, I think the them having playing cards is to interject or start, not interject actually, start the show with some bit of levity because obviously the episode is going to get very heavy and it's going to stay heavy throughout the entire episode. But yeah, you would think that they, I mean, I don't, can the aid station even call them? They have a phone. It's been established they can get calls from the aid station. You would think that if the aid station said, "Hey, there's a guy coming who's really hurt," that then the call came in and they would run up and be there. Because very rarely are they waiting on the chopper pad for somebody. It's usually, oh, the announcement. Let's go run up and do it. So obviously they know there's somebody coming. That's why they're waiting. But then why are they playing cards? Like you would think it would be a little like you think they'd all be just sort of standing there with, as you say, various tools and stuff. But yeah, you can imagine this guy. What has that pocket knife seen that it's now going into this guy's aorta? I'm like, holy God.
I think you're right, Rob, that this is a medical drama. It's leaning on the drama bit of the dramedy of MASH. And I think there are points where reality and the needs for the plot and the drama clash a little bit. So the fact that they had no preparation is all part of building the tension that the plot needs. But in reality, we would want to be well informed of what was coming our way well in advance. And, maybe the chopper radio broke, something like that. They'd find a reason to do it. But yeah, this is the drama, the reality of writing a drama. Is you've got to set up the stakes, and boy, are the stakes high here.
Yeah, I mean, like the aid station guy was new and he didn't call. He didn't call to warn them or whatever. So, okay.
Or, right, or was mistriaged, right? They might have said, "This is just a local chest wobble," and not realize that it's bad, and then you don't get that forewarning.
There you go.
So,
So, Hawkeye has a line where he says, I'm going to, the chopper pilot asks, what are you doing? Which is such scene setting, because why would the chopper pilot not going to ask that? He's going to eat his Slim Jim. What are you talking about? He's going to. So he says, what are you doing? And Hawkeye says, I'm going to compress the aorta against his spinal column to stop the bleeding. Now, obviously, this episode is incredibly medical heavy, which is why you've got the show's longtime medical advisor, Dr. Walter Deschel, as a co-writer. There are lines in this episode that you know were written by Dr. Deschel that Hawkeye, that Alan Alda clearly had to then take and kind of massage a little to make it sound like dialogue, because Dr. Deschel is not a dramatic, he's not a dramatist, you know, but there's, and I don't mean this as a criticism, I just mean as an observation of someone who's watched this episode 20,000 times, there are lines that pop out where I go, aha, that's a Deschel line, clearly. He's like, this is what we have to get across for the audience to understand, because obviously we can't see it. This isn't the pit, everybody. We can't show Hawkeye sticking his hand in the guy's chest and pressing the aorta against the spinal column to stop it from bleeding. Now, okay, again, I'm going to ask a lot of dumb questions because I don't know what the hell I'm talking about. Did that make sense? Pressing the aorta against the spinal column to pinch it off? That is medically sound in this scenario?
Yeah, up to a point. I mean, there's a lot of missing detail. So do we need to just to say the aorta is the big blood vessel that carries all your oxygenated blood out of your heart? It supplies pretty much everything in your body with oxygenated blood. So brain, the heart itself, gut, kidneys are really important. I mean, that to me is the whole thing going, what about the renal arteries? You know, that's the bit you don't know. There is a little bit later where Potter says renal failure. You go, yes, spot on. So, yes, I mean, the other thing they sort of allude to is this aorta is hamburger meat. And how much pressure on hamburger meat is effective? I don't know. I mean, Ange and I were saying how the whole, I hate to be this guy, but 20 minutes to your kidneys and your spinal cord without blood, and how long was your chopper flight, feels like it's really stretching reality. I hate to be the guy. I mean, again, this is where the needs of the show trump reality. More than a few minutes feels pretty scary to me. So, okay. But we're going with that. You know, we'll, I don't want to let daylight in on magic. You know, 20 minutes, let's go with it. That's what they need. That's what they need for this program. Let's say 20 minutes is fine.
Yeah. If I can add, I'll just sort of like say, and then I'm sorry, Chris, I cut you off. But first of all, like the first thing that I write is, how did this guy survive the helicopter ride, right?
Yeah.
His aorta is complete hamburg. He is just pouring blood out of really what is the main highway of blood out of your heart. Like, I'm surprised he's alive, first of all, right? And then second of all, you know, Rob, if you think about like it like a garden hose, if there's a big hole in your garden hose that's spraying out blood, you can compress proximally, right, like closer to the faucet. And so he probably is above the injury where he's compressing, instead of trying to compress like this hamburger, which they do describe it as, like completely shot apart. But he doesn't kind of really know where that injury is until he sees. So he's probably relatively high up. Now, remember, if you kink that tube, you're still getting blood to your brain and your heart and probably your lungs, right? Because those things branch off very early off the aorta. So it makes some sense. But like Chris said, like, how did he even make it there? I have no idea. And then God forbid there are 10 other choppers behind him. You probably say, I'm not going to operate on this guy because there are 20 other people behind him. And it really is miracle surgery that they're trying to do here. You just can't spare those resources when there's mass casualty behind, right? So hard to.
I mean, I don't want to diss this. This is a fantastic episode of MASH, and I feel, sure, you know, completely heartless criticizing the premise of it. But no, I think we have to say medically, it's a bit dubious.
Yeah, I mean, you can, right? There are all sorts of things, Chris, that you can say. Like, there was a clot there that was hanging on.
Yeah.
Bit so he wasn't bleeding until he landed, and then it started to spurt, right? Like, I've seen everything in medicine, so I can come up with an explanation for everything. But
never say never.
And it, I mean, and it could be that Hawkeye is exaggerating a little bit when he referred to it as a piece of hamburger. You know, it could be that Hawkeye is given to that sometimes. So, but okay, that's fair. So when he says, if I pinch this off for more than 20 minutes, he stands a good chance of winding up paralyzed. And he says, what time is it? We get a close up of the lock, and then bang, here we go. We've got this clock now running on the screen. And one of the things that I said many times, I think MASH season 4, not only is it my favorite season of MASH, I think it's arguably, you know, the greatest season of television anybody's ever produced in terms of the mix of comedy and drama and format busting that they were willing to do for a show that had probably 35 million viewers. They were willing to mess with the format a little. And I think as shows age and the cast gets more and more comfortable and maybe a little tired of doing the same things over and over again, a lot of shows can sometimes settle into a formula and it becomes the same thing over and over again. And so one of the things I like about season 8 is they did some format busting episodes. We'll get to Dreams in a little bit, but this is one of those where it's like, hey, let's try doing something in real time. I think that's, you know, yes, maybe it's a little, you know, a little forced, maybe a little over dramatized, but hey, they're trying to do something a little different. Now, something about the clock on the screen, I just want to mention that when this episode got remastered for Hulu, the analog clock effect on the bottom of the screen was recreated and repositioned to better complement modern day 16:9 widescreen televisions. The new placement of the clock is evident when compared to stills from the original 4:3 broadcast. I can't stand that stuff. Like, guys, just leave it alone. Not everything.
They mirror the clock in the helicopter really well. I mean, it's exactly the same thing. But I did kind of go, this is where MASH invented the TV show 24, because the whole thing about that was the ticking clock. And, you know, it was it really does add tension.
Yeah.
It's like High Noon, right? Isn't there a clock in High Noon with Gary Cooper, right?
Where not on the screen, but they kept going back to a clock and real time is passing. So yeah, absolutely. I like real time movies. You know, I think it's a fun trick. So I like that they're doing this, right? I like that they're breaking the reality of like, oh, you know, you're kind of reminding people you're watching a television show because now we're seeing this thing on the screen. So they get the guy on the Jeep and they're driving down and they all start talking about what to do. And BJ says, how about you pack them in ice? Hypothermia might reduce the chance of paralysis. And Hawkeye says, Klinger, go get my canvas bathtub, which he got rid of in the last season. Why does he have the canvas bathtub again? By the way, he told Colonel Potter he's getting rid of it, but okay, whatever. So then Klinger runs off and he says, how bad is you could tell until I get inside and take a look at it. Now, hypothermia, guys, we all know from the world of comic books, hypothermia solves everything, right? You can be dead for 100 years, but if you're in the ice, you come out and you're the super soldier again. It's all good. What does hypothermia do in this scenario? Whichever one he wants to go, explain what that does for what can we do for this nation.
Let me say one thing, and then I'll hand hypothermia off to Chris. So the first thing that I'm going to say is, when you are about to face a resuscitation, like this is happening, right? The most important thing as the leader is to assign roles to make sure that everybody knows what they're supposed to do. And so one of the things that I really love is that as the Jeep is going down, he tells Margaret, we need those special vascular clamps, get those vascular clamps. He tells Klinger, I want to do hypothermia, get my bathtub and get as much ice as possible. He tells Kelly, we need arterial grafts, get the arterial grafts ready. We need to ventilate him, get an anesthesiologist, right? And so even before they get there, he is mobilizing his team and everybody knows what their responsibility is, because until, like, when you are in there, the last thing you want to know is who's delivering the medications. No, there has to be somebody that, like, you are my medication nurse, you are my bedside nurse, you are my airway doctor, you are my primary survey person, right? And so everybody knows what they're doing. Everybody knows the information they need to tell you. And then you ingest that information and say that. So I thought that was superb, right? He is like making sure the OR is ready, one of which is hypothermia, which I will kick off to Chris to talk about.
Strong agree. I absolutely had that on my notes as well. Firstly, The instruction to the Jeep driver is go like hell, but I love how the nurses can keep up at what is clearly a slow jog and overtake the Jeep when he sends them off. But you're absolutely right. Hawkeye's a terrific team leader. He's thinking ahead, he's planning ahead, he's giving really clear instructions. I think that's vital as well. You know, people are not kind of going, what did he mean? They knew exactly what he meant. So I would strongly agree with that. Also, it was BJ who comes up with the idea of the ice bath. And not Hawkeye. So, you know, hats off to BJ. What does cold do? There is an expression, a rather morbid expression, I'm afraid. You're not dead until you're warm and dead. And what that means is that, what that means is if you were, let's say It's a Wonderful Life, you fall in the lake, you're Harry, you fall in the lake and you're very, very cold. And let's say your heart stops. That could preserve you to a certain extent. It could protect some of your tissues because the cold just shuts everything down. It stops deterioration of the tissues. So we were just saying, you know, a kidney might survive 10, 15 minutes without a blood supply. But we know, because we've seen a lot of films, that you can transport a kidney across town if you pack it in ice. And also you smuggle diamonds, because we also know that's always what happens when you're packing an organ in ice. So the cold really protects you and shuts it down. So the idea of moving into a bath of ice, although they have to grab their ice, again, your super duper tertiary ED, do you have a cold thing, Ange? But you know, they have to cobble something together by, you know, getting ice from wherever they can. But it is a sound principle that actually, if you're trying to preserve this guy, making him as cold as possible is a good idea. So yeah, that's a realistic point. Do you have special kit for that, Ange?
Yeah, so like Chris says, it slows down metabolism, right? So that blood, that cell that isn't getting oxygen or blood supply is almost in a little bit of stasis. Not a lot, but a little bit. And so we do have things that warm and cold when we need to. And for me, the most useful time or the most time that I've seen hypothermia be done is if somebody has had a cardiac arrest and you have resuscitated them so that they have spontaneous circulation again, there is permissive hypothermia where you keep people just a few degrees under normal as a way to sort of like not have everything sort of like suddenly rebound. So we do have something that it's like, oh my God, it looks like a big hefty bag basically that you can either crank the heat up or crank it down. It does cover the body, so it makes things like physical examination a little bit difficult. But that's just me and my, you know, I always say I'm a simple ER doctor. They probably have fancier things in the OR in the ICU that I don't know about.
Is it called a bear hugger? Is
Yeah,
that a
they call
thing?
it the bear hugger. The bear hugger is still around. But we also have things like we can give heated fluids and we can give cold fluids if we need to, right? Not it's more heated than anything. So
Is the amount of ice that they're going to be able to get for? I know that's part of the episode is that they can't get enough ice, but like, could you possibly put him in enough ice to give him hypothermia? I mean, just that being in a canvas bathtub full of ice is not falling into an icy river. Those are two very different things.
no,
Yeah, I
Rob,
mean,
you need to be frozen in a block like Captain America.
right.
That's the only way it works.
Well, I'll say, Rob, like, you know, you don't want them to be 60 degrees, right? Because you probably no coming back from that, right? So you're probably saying, like, let's get them to like 93, 92, 90, somewhere around there. And you probably can, at least any hypothermia is better than fever for sure, right? You don't want him in a hypermetabolic state. You want him in a hypometabolic state.
And by the way, I like how that scene is directed by Alan Alda. I like that he puts the camera on the hood of the Jeep and we follow it in one long shot. I mean, aside from the clock being on the screen and it being in real time, there are some oneers in this episode to kind of add to the level of difficulty that Alan Alda presented for himself, which gives this episode a visual distinctiveness aside from the clock on the screen that makes it memorable because he's got a real good facility with the camera in terms of where to put it, move it around, and do a lot of these shots where you've got 10, 12 actors, all multiple. I love being on the hood, seeing them all, and then them fanning off as he's giving the orders. It's Klinger, Margaret, Kelly. You know, I like that there's eight people, five people, three people. Like that's all just very, very distinctive. And of course, there is no laugh track on this episode. They're able to, you know, I never know
Oh,
how that
good.
worked. The you can imagine that. I know that the network was always breathing down their necks on that stuff. It's kind of amazing that a show this popular couldn't just tell them kiss off, you know. But obviously, in their certain episodes, they were able to force it through, and this is one of them. So.
I'm glad you said that. I was going to ask you that because this, if ever there was not a need for a laugh track, this is the episode.
There's a couple episodes of like the Quo Vadis Captain Chandler. There's no laugh track on that one because they realized like, okay, you know, this is just inappropriate. So they were able to really force it when they had to, obviously. So they get the patient inside. Margaret, she says, Margaret, get me those vascular clamps. She says, I can't find them. Now, of course, those are the vascular clamps that they were referring to in season six for the patent 4077th episode, where they get the vascular clamps made, which again, nice bit of content. MASH was so not worried about its continuity. So it's kind of nice that they remembered, oh, yeah, we made a whole show about we're the only unit that has these vascular clamps. And of course, Margaret, you know, Margaret's trying to find them. And then Roy Goldman says, I don't have AB negative, I've got O positive. And Hawkeye talks about it. I don't want to give him that much uncross matched blood, especially a different type. And BJ says you can only give him what you've got. Now, again, guys, I thought you couldn't do that. I thought you had to have type to type. Is that not correct?
I want to talk about the clamps first,
Oh, okay.
and
Sure.
you know, again, when you talk about efficiency, right? Like when I think about my resuscitation room in the emergency department, I know where everything is. I know where the most important equipment is. I know where the most important but least used equipment is, right? And so the fact that they're like, we hid those clamps to keep them safe, they're in my foot locker, makes zero sense. Like that is stupidity beyond belief, right? And so like that, like you could imagine, let's say they actually had an arterial graft at the ready and it took them 10 minutes to find the clamps that somebody hid somewhere. That's 10 minutes of your 20 minutes that you don't have, right? So the first thing that I have to say is that is idiotic, right? Like, you know, there has to be like a place that you have vascular clamps and a big sign. They're always there. People know not to use them for any reason other than vascular clamps. So I like few parts of this were like, I can't believe I'm hearing that. That was one of them. Oh, it's underneath my nudie mags in my sock, in my foot locker. Like, what are you even saying, man? So
Yes.
that's my point. From the resuscitation point of view, that makes no sense.
Yeah, it's an interesting definition of the word. We wanted to keep it safe by having it under the Journal of Competitive Nudity. And I'm not going to blow past that because I just want to know, how does one, as it were, get on top when it's competitive nudity? That is an interesting take. So yeah, completely agree. Everything labeled, everything in its place. You need that in a second. And if you cannot lay, you know, it is, this is a bad bit of leadership. Is yes, I kept it in my foot locker. We see Margaret delving around in the foot locker. There was a missed opportunity for her not to find the journal and be look horrified or bemused or whatever. But there we go. You want to talk about uncross match plus. I notice I'm getting the difficult medical questions, but that's all
No, I
right.
can talk too. I can talk too.
I
I just,
prepped. It's
yeah.
fine. So this is about, so everybody I think probably knows about blood typing and blood grouping. Okay. So this is about different types of what we call antigens on the surface of blood cells. So there is A and there is B, and you can have A or B or A and B or none at all. And that we call O. So what they are doing here is giving him a neutral blood type, but it is not without consequences. So there are various things that can happen when you give too much of an unmatched type. So you can first, you can just flood the body with too much blood. Now, difficult in this guy who is hosing blood out of what looks like a hamburger piece of an aorta, but you could give too much and dilute everything down. You could cause problems with the actual blood cells so that there's an immune response and they break apart and you get something really nasty called DIC, which is where you get blood clots forming within the blood vessels. That's very bad news. That usually is fatal. You can overload the circulation. You can cause lung injuries. You can cause metabolic problems. So here's a stat for you. In one study, mortality increased to 52% for patients receiving 4 units of uncrossed matched blood and up to 100% for five or more. So there is a limit to how much you can give.
Okay.
Yeah. And I'm
I told you
starting.
I told you I prepped. I did my homework for this episode.
Yeah. And you know, he, you know, I have to say, right, he's AB negative and they're giving O positive, and that negative and positive is a bigger deal than that, right? You know, like they're Rh incompatible. He could definitely have an autoimmune response to this. I wonder if it was a typo. I wonder if it was supposed to be O negative, the universal donor. But I think if the plan is like, well, he's going to die unless I give him something, like they're really doing miraculous work here, like trying to save this guy. So, I mean, I already have my dirty hand holding your vital organ. I may as well give you some unmatched blood, see what happens, right? You know,
In
so
for a penny, in for a
that's what I mean, right? And so I just wondered if it was a if it might have been a mistake, that, but I guess if we're ramping up the drama, giving him unmatched blood probably adds a little bit of drama.
Yeah, you give every hurdle you can. By the way, I'm picturing Ange a scenario where like a patient comes in and they need some piece of like specialized medical tool that you've hidden, and they're like Ange, where is it? And you're like, it's behind the first 13 issues of Daring New Adventures of Supergirl. And then
Yeah, what?
the nurse goes to get it and she can't find it, and you're like, no, that's the 90s run of Supergirl. I said Daring New Adventures, that's the 80s book, that's where it is.
It's not a problem. It's not a problem, Rob, because the nurses all know that it's a part of Angie's gin still in his office. So, you know.
Crazy.
By the way, when did they discover that blood had types? When did they learn that? Like in American medicine, when did we in across the world?
I think it's probably sort of in like the tens or twenties, if I have to say.
Okay.
I mean, we'll have to look, but I think like back when, you know, like the show The Nick, right? Like around that time period.
I've heard of it, but I've never seen it. I heard that's pretty gruesome, but no, I haven't seen it. So, okay. So
Oh, here we
RHE.
go. There we go. Google is the answer.
Okay.
Blood typing history began with Karl Landsteiner's 1901 discovery of the
There you
ABO
go,
blood
Ange.
types, rhesus factor 1940. So that was much newer for this setting.
Okay. All right. Wow. The very Price is Right, Angie did it without going over, kind of thing. It was perfect. So, Hawkeye. And then BJ says, "Hey, wait a minute. Those clamps are in the swamp." And of course, Margaret gives the proper response. What the hell are they doing in the swamp? By the way, Colonel Potter, a little asleep on the switch here, right? It's his unit. I think he would. Also, they didn't get a second pair made. Like, once you've got the first pair, you could say, "Well, just copy this." Like, you know what? They've had time. To get, I know this MASH timeline is compressed, and that episode probably took place a month ago compared to, the 3 seasons of whatever, but still. So anyway, he says those things are irreplaceable. We wanted to keep them somewhere safe. Again, because you guys get to make that decision, right? Just get to So anyway, Hawkeye mentions that they're near their Norwegian kippers and Winchesters. Those are my kippers, you animal. So then Klinger comes in with the tub and he's got the ice, and he says, "That's all you could find." And he says, "I'm sorry, I'm a desert person." And it's ice in this canvas bag that they find. So they lower this guy down, and we don't really see a whole lot. And then they say, "Go to the officers' club, go to that." And then there's this bit where Klinger says, "I'll be back in a trice with the ice." And then they have this little dissertation about, Winchester's like trice, and Klinger's like, "Oh, I'm 15 ways to a better vocabulary, major." That scene was cut in syndication. I never saw any of that. It's just Winchester going trice, and then that's it. And they talk about Funk and Wagnall and all this stuff. So again, it's a little offhand.
It's the closest you get to humor in this half of the episode, really. So, it's the gag, it's the joke. I love that Klinger is doing this sort of correspondence course to improve himself while he's in Korea.
He's always
It's
training,
great.
right? He's always trying to come up with something he can do when he gets back. He's looking ahead.
Yes.
But then we get this great moment where we hear the guy moaning because he's waking up. And I would imagine waking up with a man with his hand in your chest probably hurts a lot. And Television shows in the 70s and the 80s, this is right, of course, the tail end of the 70s, they can't get too gruesome, right? They can't get too visceral because there were standards and practices that would limit these things. And the amount of moaning and screaming on MASH was always pretty tamped down because of that reason. I think they just couldn't have people really sounding. But I love the way this guy is moaning. Like, it sounds real. It's not the fake acting moaning. It's like, it's guttural, because I can't wrap my head around what would that feel like to wake up with someone's hand on your heart. I don't, you know.
I would strongly recommend not trying it, Rob.
Yes, thank you. Yes. I'll write that down, Chris. Yeah, don't
there's
do that.
There's quite a lot of gore in this one. There's quite a lot of blood. And every time I come on, I note how poorly served anesthesiology is in MASH. You know, this is the most complex of cases. The man's blood pressure is crashing through the floor, and their approach to anesthesia is stick on the mask and twist the knob. It's really scary.
Yeah, I'll say there are two moans and breathing that I think has been tremendously acted in this episode, and we'll get to one in a little bit later. But if you think about this, Rob, what has happened is this guy's pouring out blood. They've clamped off that hole in the hose. They've given him blood. Now his brain is getting more perfused, right? Because he was basically like profoundly anemic from trauma. And so like he was unconscious before because his brain wasn't getting a lot of blood. Now his brain is getting a lot of blood. So he's starting to wake up, but you would think that they would have been like, we should gas him down as soon as he arrives. Right. There's no, at the very least, we need to do some things. So the fact they waited that long, but of course I think in the heat of the moment, he's not moving. You might not even be thinking about it. Right. This is all reacting to things as it sort of unrolls.
Yeah.
Right. So we get to Margaret running in to the swamp, by the way. She doesn't go for Hawkeye's footlocker. She goes for BJ's. BJ's footlocker is between the two of them. Hawkeye's footlocker is further backstage, so they just sort of skip over that. By the way, I was going to say, Margaret is wearing a like cut-off T-shirt. Loretta Swift's got some guns here. She looks great. Like, this is a very flattering look for her, I thought, with her hair up and the thing on. So she goes in. So she goes right for BJ's footlocker, and she pulls the, you know, she's reaching for things. We then go to the mess tent, and we go to the O Club, and Klinger is talking to Igor, and he says, you know, gonna get the ice, and Igor says there's not much. There's a lot of guys leaving today, so they're trying to get loaded before the bus does. So there's only just a little bit of ice that they can do. And he, you know, they give Igor a line. He says, we have to water down the drinks. Otherwise they could taste the booze that way. So, then we get back to Margaret, and she is pulling the vascular clamp out of this disgusting sock that is, and she kind of like, it's sticking to her hand a little bit. So then Kelly comes in and has this collection of arterial grafts, and they have this argument about what size will fit. Now, let me ask you guys, how do you keep pieces of tissue like that sustainable for a long period? I mean, they obviously have a bank of these things. How do you do that? How do you keep that stuff viable, that it doesn't just wither away into nothing?
I mean, you can put in some preservative, and again, probably keep it on ice is probably the best way to do it.
Yeah. And these days, I don't think they use this kind of grafting at all. They're, you know, they developed woven synthetic grafts like Dacron. So they're quite interesting grafts because they're sort of Y-shaped because it's got to be like that. And they're also corrugated because the pressure changes, means you've got to have some flexibility in it. So they're quite interesting things.
Yeah. And can I just say, the understanding as an Italian-American, the pasta discussion just drives me nuts, right? Like, here's a grown man whose aorta is ripped, and he's like, no, we need rigatoni. That's like so small. That's like a newborn's aorta, right? You need like a manicotti pasta tube. Like, don't even know what you're talking about. That spaghettini, you need a rigatoni. It's like, clearly these are
cannelloni at the least. Yeah.
Don't understand pasta at all.
And Alda's Italian. Alan Alda's Italian. His that's because like his real name was some. It's like an Italian name. He changed it. I think his father changed it. So he is Italian. But I'm half Italian, and as we will have a whole discussion of Italian later on this season with Dr. Angini and Scott X. But Yeah, the rigatoni. I mean, rigatoni is pretty small, pretty small.
Yeah. I was pleased to see Nurse Kelly, but I did kind of go, I'm not sure how this ethnic food discussion sits these days. Maybe it's more acceptable in 1981, but I'll blow past it. I was just pleased to see her doing something and having a line, and she was
Yes.
quite active. She did the anesthetics at the end, I think, didn't she?
Yeah, so they, and she says, that Anderson, we don't have any that big. And he says, how we've taken pieces from now.
I'm
Okay.
surprised they hadn't, given the material they have to work with. I'm surprised they didn't have a ready supply of aortas, if I'm honest. Bit
So
grim,
the
but there we go.
So the aorta is the biggest one, right? So that's what you're saying, is that's the biggest one. Okay. So the, and they damn well, again, they haven't. I mean, how long could those pieces survive, right? And even if you kept them in ice, how long could that possibly be?
I'm a bit scared that they've kept them all in one jar as well.
It's like a
One going
Frankenstein
off my,
thing.
you know. I think the answer to the question, Rob, is this is not common modern medical practice.
Okay.
And I don't know is the answer, because these
Yeah.
days, I don't think they would, not a vascular surgeon, but I don't think there would be much of a case for using another human part when you could use a synthetic part that's just as good, or if arguably better. So I don't know is the answer, because I it's not something I've ever seen.
And I'm going to say I don't know as well. My guess is that they have so much people coming through so frequently that they're probably like anything that we can salvage, we'll keep. And maybe like after a couple of days, you have to throw them out. But there's such a supply of things coming in. So.
Okay. Well, that's what I was wondering, because if it's a couple of days, if they can't last more than a couple of days, they've talked about that there are times where the 477th goes through droughts of no patients. So it could
Yeah.
be we had them all and we didn't get any wounded for a week, and that material had to be thrown out because it's no longer viable. And now they don't have any supply, to use it or whatever. So Klinger comes in with a little bit of ice, and Alan Alda does a great, screaming as it's painful for him. And then she's like, don't, Margaret comes in and she's like, I got the clamps. And he says, well, bring them over. And she's like, what do you mean bring them over? They're soaking in alcohol. And then he does point out, I've had my unsterilized hand in this man's body for the past 10 minutes. And then she says, what kind of nurse do you think I am? I'm not going to let an instrument go from your dirty sock to that man's heart. Your hand will last a few seconds more. I love that Margaret runs roughshod over everybody, right? Margaret, she's not taking shit from Hawkeye. It doesn't matter. Now, you guys have already talked about the unsterilization thing is bad, but does Hawkeye have a point at all?
Yes. I want to talk to this, because I think this is a really interesting scene. You've got Hawkeye's pragmatism of, if I don't keep my unsterilized fist in this man's chest, he's gonna die. And you've got Margaret going, equipment should be sterile. Both of them are right. And I think that this, and I again, I'm looking to Ange how it is on your side of the Atlantic, but I think quite a lot of discussions that we have as doctors and nurses about patients often reflect this, because I think doctors have a certain more latitude in how we do things. We've got that slightly more pragmatic thing, and nurses are really good at following protocols, and protocols are there for a really good reason. But sometimes we have the nurses saying it should be done this way, and we're saying, but it has to be done this way. And that's, everybody's got the patient's best interests at heart. Nobody's doing wrong. But I think it's a really interesting little 1 minute, in a nutshell, of how interactions between different medical professionals can play out. And Angie's partner is a nurse, so I'm going to let him talk to
Oh no. First of all, she's a
it
physician's assistant, not a nurse, which
now.
is a
Oh, I beg your
whole
pardon. I
different
do
category.
beg your pardon. I take it back.
But I
Is that
have to tell
true?
you, Chris.
Do you recognize that?
I gotta tell you, Chris, like I put in like I bolded, made the font bigger, and highlighted in my notes like so true. And I'm so glad you said it. The word that you used that I had on the tip of my tongue is protocolized, right? The nurses are very protocolized. We have our protocol. This is how we do things. We do these protocols for a reason. This is for patient safety. This is how things have to happen. And the doctors are often like, no. Like sometimes we have to break protocol, right? They're not chiseled in stone by Moses, right? Like there are guidelines that should be broken. We say, 5 to 10% of the time, where you have to go off protocol sometimes because that's what's in the best interest. And so the fact that she's like, again, he was handling dirty money on a, you know, a dust filled helipad, right? What are 2 minutes of alcohol for those clamps going to matter? Zero, right? So, but you know, she has to follow her protocol. But I always keep thinking in this thing, right? You know, again, they didn't have a graft, but if they had a graft ready and time is of the essence, and she took 2 minutes to sterilize the thing when his dirty hand was in his chest, that's 2 minutes of time. Now, they didn't have a graft, so it, you know, from a timing point of view, it didn't matter. But this felt so true. There is often a push pull. Doctors and nurses, as we try to figure out what is safe, what is not safe, what are we doing, why are we doing that, all of those sort of things. But we're all, as Chris said, the patient's best interest is in mind, and sometimes you just have to come to consensus. If he said, I am ordering you as the physician, give me that dirty clamp right now, she probably would have to do it. But I think they're all working together here.
I would remind you that these clamps were under some kippers and the Journal of Competitive Nudity. So maybe 2 minutes of alcohol is not necessarily such a bad idea.
No, for sure, right? It's in somebody's dirty sock, right? But, you know, why don't they have gloves on the topper pad? Like, there's so many things I could say about this, but here we are.
And that's how long it takes? 2 minutes? I was about to ask, how long does it take to sterilize something?
Oh, you need a microbiologist on to give you the proper answer. But yes, they would have it in for hours, wouldn't they?
Yeah, right.
Oh, really?
They have machines that they put these things through to sterilize.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
Oh,
but
wow.
2 minutes is better than nothing, right?
Yeah.
You know,
okay. Yeah.
All right. So then we're out on the compound, and we finally get our first scene with Colonel Potter, almost halfway into the episode. Actually, no, we've been talking for an hour. We're 7 minutes into the episode, everybody.
I'm so sorry.
And this is why you bring us on, Rob. This is why you bring us on.
I made no plans for this morning. I made no plans. So I took the dog out for a walk before we started recording. So anyway, we get our first appearance of Colonel Potter, and obviously it's a very light load. There's one patient that Potter's going to deal with, and then there's another one that BJ is looking at, and we see that this patient is clearly dying. He's got a brain injury, and he says his pulse is his blood pressure is down, his pulse is down, his blood pressure is up, and he's clearly going to die. There's nothing they can do. And then BJ says, I want to stay with the boy. And Potter's a little like, why? You can't do anything for him. And then he says, well, Hawkeye's got a kid in OR that may be missing a piece of his aorta. Potter, of course, immediately understands what's going on. Again, nice little piece of filmmaking here where Alan Alda has got the camera through the bus window. And BJ and Potter are having this discussion, but in the foreground is Father Mulcahy giving him the last rites. I just think that's a nice bit of framing of that. We see that Father Mulcahy is doing what he needs to do while the more literal discussions are going on in the background. And then, you know, Mulcahy kind of notices that BJ looks a little off, and he says, are you all right, BJ? And BJ says, I just feel helpless just waiting for this boy to die. It's not what I was trained for. And, he says, I'll tell Hawkeye. And, you know, for an episode that is, you know, written by Alan Alda, directed by Alan Alda, starring Alan Alda, I'm glad that BJ gets something to do. I don't mean that sounds a little, you know, condescending almost, but you know, it could be easy to just make this the Hawkeye show. If you weren't careful, but I like that BJ gets his own, you know, first, as you mentioned, Chris, he's the one who comes up with the hypothermia idea. And of course, you know, he's dealing with his own pressure. So then he meets another patient. Roberts, played by the actor, Kevin, I wrote in my notes Kevin Trophy, but I think it's Kevin Brophy. I think my notes auto-corrected. He was born in 1953, passed away just last year. He was in an episode of Aftermath. He's in the movie Goodfellas, credited as mobster. That doesn't help me figure out who he was in Goodfellas. Now, obviously, he's a good 10 years older in Goodfellas. I've seen that movie 5,000 times because it's the song of my people. So I'll have to try and find him in that movie. But anyway, before we go further, you guys want to talk about this patient that they've found here that is going to die?
Oh, there's a ton of medicine here. Okay. That's very quickly said, right? But he has this traumatic brain injury. He has a bloody bandage on his head, but I don't think it's if part of his head has been blown off, because really what they're describing is when you have so much swelling or bleeding inside your brain that you've kind of overwhelmed the volume capacity of the skull, and something is going on that we call herniation. When there's too much bleeding or swelling in the skull such that the brain doesn't fit anymore, it actually squishes through the hole at the bottom of the skull, which we call herniation. The brain is coming out of the foramen magnum at the base of the skull. And so he's got signs of that. His pupils are fixed and dilated, which means that his cranial nerves affecting the eyes have been impeded. His blood pressure is up and his heart rate is down, which is two elements of a triad we call Cushing's triad, which means that there is so much swelling in the brain that you need to sort of either take control immediately or recognize that things are too far gone. And the fact that the pupils are fixed and dilated is a sign that we say that herniation has most likely already happened. The third element of Cushing's triad is agonal breathing or respiratory distress, which we actually see a little bit later in this. And so that's why BJ has already said we're too far gone here. His pupils are fixed and dilated, and he's already showing vital signs that he's brain dead, basically. So those are all medical facts that are sort of like tossed in as one line. Clearly, this is whatever that physician who sort of like helped write this, threw that in there to sort of let the doctors in the watching know this guy is too far gone.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. I think, I mean, I'm not going to talk about the medicine. I'm just going to talk about this as a scene because I think it's really important. And I love how it contrasts with all the Sturm und Drang that's going on around Hawkeye in the OR. It's, you get your three sort of most emotionally sensitive characters here. You get BJ, you got Mulcahy, and you get Potter. And they are quiet, they are respectful, they are professional, they treat the patient with dignity and humanity, they treat each other with dignity and humanity. They all see how ghastly this is, such a waste. The VCID is 19, what a waste of a youthful life. And I really like, there's a bit at the end, Mulcahy is about to go and he turns back and says to BJ, are you okay? Mm-hmm. And that checking in with each other in these awful traumatic situations, BJ is never afraid to show vulnerability, which I think is so important to us as doctors. It is very important to do the Hawkeye thing and the Winchester thing and be invulnerable. And we ain't. And BJ is never afraid to show that vulnerability. And Mulcahy picks up on it, just innately knows that he is not in a good place and says, are you okay? He knows that he feels helpless and hopeless and he checks in. And that for trauma teams is such an important part at the end of it to kind of check in on each other. And then you get Roberts who just ladles on the emotional blackmail. You got to do something. A BJ knows there's nothing he can do. And the only thing he can do is use this guy's spare parts for somebody else's life. And that is, and you can see it. It's so beautifully acted, that bit. You can see it in his face. And he goes through the normal emotions. He does look sad. He does get angry. Who wouldn't in that situation? So I love this scene. I think it's such a good compliment. We talk about A and B plots. I don't think of this as B plot. I just think it's another part of the A plot.
Yeah, it's all one.
Yeah. To build on what Chris said, we have mandated now when there is a death in the emergency department or a traumatic event that there is both what they call a hot debrief, where you get the team that was involved with that during that shift to sort of say like, hey, what went well? What didn't go well? How is everybody doing? If people need a break, take a break. And then what they call a warm debrief, like days later, where you try to get the same people together to say, like, now everybody's had a little bit more time to think about this. How is everybody doing? Yeah. So that's, I agree that, like, you know, that, like, I'm a physician and I have to go on. Those days are kind of over. People recognize that this can weigh on people, and you have to sort of get your feelings out and, like, talk things through to make sure that everything is okay. In the ED, it's very impressive. Like, everybody loves everybody there. So people know when something happens, and, like, when things have happened for, you know, with me, the emails that I get that are like, hey, just checking in, or text, hey, just checking in, it is crucial. And I agree that BJ gets the emotional half of this episode, yeah, whereas Hawkeye gets the procedural half, yeah, of this episode, but they are, yeah, meshed so intently that it really is just wonderful.
Yeah. They have mentioned on MASH before that it is standard operating, no pun intended, procedure for the aid station physician to not send patients like this onto the 477, that when someone is going to die, you don't send them along, I guess, because you're using up resources, although we see the bus is virtually empty. So he's not taking up a space that some other soldier could be getting. But they, in the episode, in the third season episode, OR, they get that patient in where Colonel Blake consults with Hawkeye, and they look at this guy and they say, my God, half his chest is gone. And they say he never should have been sent here. And obviously, I mean, you know, people make mistakes. There could be a new kid at the aid station who just took everybody on the, and again, the bus is virtually empty, so it's, what's the harm? But yes, sending this guy along is probably not SOP because he's going to die. But of course, in this case, it works out because that's, you know.
I gotta say, Rob, like, one of the things that we say is, like, time is the best diagnostic tool. He might not have had blown pupils in the field, right? Mm. And so you just sort of say, like, if it's a 20-minute drive to get to the yeah, hospital, yeah, crap happens in the back of the bus, yes, right? So, yeah, so
that swelling you were describing develops over time, and if it pushes your brain out during that transit, it's, you could have looked, you're not going to look great, but you could have looked okay, and it gets worse during the transport.
For sure. Okay. You, okay. You're bleeding in your brain. That blood keeps bleeding. You know, things happen. Right. So
then, yeah, Roberts really, as you say, Chris, ladles it on because he's like, you know, you just can't just let him die. You're a doctor. And BJ comes in and says, look, and I kind of like just a little bit of verisimilitude where he goes, look, and he looks at the guy's dog tag and he's like, Roberts, because, I mean, he doesn't know this kid's name, you know. I mean, just, it's just that little detail of going, having to look, like, oh, what is your name? You're not going to take the time to say, what's your name? Roberts. Okay, Roberts. He just looks at the tag. Okay, Roberts. And he says, as much as I'd like to, there's some things I can't fix. And poor BJ, this kid, he's like, you can't just let him die. And literally, as they're carrying him out of the frame, he's yelling, don't let him die. It's like, okay, I've had a bad enough day here for Roberts.
Yeah, Roberts is slightly on the melodramatic side, I would say. But also, you flip that round, you know, what if BJ was the first one to that stretcher on the copter and had his hand in the chest? Can you imagine Hawkeye having that conversation? I don't think you can. It's BJ that is the holistic one who sees everybody around this patient who, you know, again, he doesn't know him, but he says, this person who is about to die was important to you. And I will give you the time of day, even though you are making my day harder. You are making my already bad emotional state worse. Yeah. He gives him the time and he gives him the decency. BJ's a terrific doctor. I think I've said before, not sure I'd like to work with Hawkeye, but I'd certainly work with BJ.
plenty of docs would have just walked away, right? Yeah. This guy's screaming at me, but bye, right? So I agree. BJ to him shows that, you know, that's a patient interaction in and of itself, right? Talking to, like, parents or a spouse or a good friend. So
So Mulcahy runs in and he tells Hawkeye that BJ has a patient whose pupils are fixed and dilated, and Hawkeye says, you know, well, I hope so. He says that guy could stay alive for hours, which obviously is true. And then Margaret finally comes in with the clamps. And he says, and then Winchester points out, you know, you're going to use all the blood on this one case. what happens if we get inundated with more casualties, which is a good detail to remember, to think in the moment. Hawkeye then asks Cleaner, go get on the horn and see if we've got any wounded coming. Margaret puts in gloves and she says, I hate this. I haven't even scrubbed. So she's putting her gloves on, or her dirty hands, presumably. So then we come back out in the field and we get this really extraordinarily well shot scene of BJ is carrying the patient, BJ and the nurse and one of the corpsmen is carrying the patient out. Mulcahy sort of checks on him, then climbs into a Jeep and starts driving. And of course the camera must have been, they've put it on the hood of this Jeep because we see Mulcahy driving like off the compound. And he says, he starts talking to his Lord and he says, dear God, I've never asked this before. And I don't know what you're thinking of asking now, but if you're going to take him anyway, so we can save the other boy. And that is our act break. And that, I think that is a really, really extraordinary little piece of filmmaking on Alan Alda's part, to put the camera, to have multiple people again, moving into the frame and then having this mechanical piece of business that where William Christopher has to start the Jeep, drive it out. And then to kind of like you just mentioned, Chris, that it's like BJ gets the heart part of this Ange, I think you said BJ gets the emotional part of this and Hawkeye gets the procedural part of this. Well, to Mulcahy, this is a big moment. This is a big deal for him to sort of say, I want this guy to die as soon as possible if he's going to, and that is going to not sit well with him. And I just think that's a great in an episode so focused on Hawkeye, Father Mulcahy gets this great little bit. It's a great way to end the act break.
It's quite a downer to the, I mean, actually the both the first and the second half sounds acting quite downer kind of ways. I think I want to come back to Charles as well for a sec, but I think with Mulcahy, what I think is we've just talked about the sort of, you know, the protocolized and the off-piste bit. I think Mulcahy is going through that. The protocol says the priest should be praying for everybody's life and be carried on and, you know, for as long as possible. And the pragmatic bit of him sees that that is not going to happen. And actually you can come out, you could lose two lives here, but there's a chance you could come out with one. And I think he is going through that internal tension, just as the same as the doctors and nurses are coming from different aspects. Mulcahy is living that, you know, spiritually, psychologically. I don't know quite what that is. But yeah, it's a really, like you say, huge moment for him to be coming to terms and applying his faith and his belief to a very real world situation. I wanted to come back to Charles because I think Charles comes off very Charles-ish, if I can put it that way. He's quite a naysayer and he's quite a critic. But I want to come to his defense a little bit, because what Charles is verbalizing are the sorts of things that go through our heads internally all the time. You know, should I be devoting this much resource to a case which has very little chance of working? He is right to call out the blood use. You know, he is right to say, but what if we get more people coming down the line? You know, later on, he says, should you have cut out the aorta, not knowing for sure that a graft is coming? And all of that we do internally, you know, we sort of test our hypotheses. New information is coming into us all the time. And we're sort of weighing it up and questioning ourselves whilst usually, certainly in my case, I'm talking to a patient. Could it be this? Could it be that? Is it Lyme's disease? Is it rheumatic fever? Is it this? Is it that? We're doing all of that. And I think Charles's role in this particular show is to be the inner monologue that I've got going on all the time in a consultation, is to challenge and to test and to say, is this a good idea? Are you right? It's a defense of him because I think it looks like he's being quite negative, but that's just the internal process we go through.
I completely agree. I'm always trying to be three steps ahead of the game. Okay, I'm getting this blood work, but what if it's abnormal? Okay, then what am I going to do then? And then what if that's abnormal? Yeah. And then do I have an ICU bed that I can send this patient to? As you're sort of like weaving your way through this, and it's true that if there were I just keep saying, if there are 10 more choppers coming, you can't have Hawkeye's hand in a chest for 10 minutes. That means somebody outside is probably dying, right? And so there is this, when we talk about, you know, we do drills at the hospital, God forbid I don't have to ever get there, but if there was a mass casualty, right, you have to sort of like triage these patients and decide who am I going to devote time to and who am I just not going to devote time to. So I will agree that Charles is saying things that should be said, because maybe, you know, you have to tell Hawkeye, who is don't let the bastard win, right? You have to say, like, maybe this is the time that the bastard has to win this case, so that those other cases can be okay. I agree that Charles is saying it right. And I'll just say again, the shot of the camera on the Jeep and Father Mulcahy saying, you know, God, kill this man. I can't imagine that he has said that too often. And it does give a little bit of pathos to the whole thing. Everybody is struggling with what's happening here. I just think it's wonderful.
Yeah. By the way, this episode, very, very pretty well, the syndicated version that I saw was pretty well edited as best they could. Like, most of the stuff that got cut was the stuff about the Funkin' Wagnall and the trice, the stuff that was not related to the medicine. But one thing I did notice is this episode, the act break, there is about 3 seconds of black screen with the clock just ticking. There's no other audio. There's no other video. It's just a tick, 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 tick. And then they go to commercial, and then it comes back for 2 seconds of tick, 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 tick. That they cut in syndication. I never saw that. It always just cut very hard, because I'm sure the editor was like, I gotta get 5 seconds out of the show. We don't need black screen. So that's fine. But I
have sympathy. I think this is a hard one to cut, isn't it? I mean, there's so much critical stuff. Yeah. I mean, I like the fact that they do that, because it reminds us that, you know, we get so caught up in the story. Time is of the essence is the reminder, isn't it? You know,
it's a nice little detail.
It's important that it's there. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. I'm sure that is something that most television networks were against, of like, what do you mean? We're not giving our viewers 3 seconds of black screen. MASH is like, no, we got to do this. Okay. So we come out of the commercial break and we're back. And then Klinger is on the phone with I-Corps trying to find out if there is more wounded coming, but he won't get it. They won't give him any information. The guy says, I can only give that information to your commanding officer. And Klinger's like, my CO is in surgery. He can't come to the radio. And the guy's like, sorry, Corporal. So then Klinger makes a command decision by pretending to be Colonel Potter, delivering what is, in my estimation, the best Harry Morgan impression that any of the other actors have ever done, with this, what in the name of sweet Franny Adams is going on? And I love that when the guy's like, Colonel Potter, is that you? And of course, it doesn't sound remotely like Harry Morgan, but it is the spirit of Harry Morgan. And of course, he gets all the dialogue ready. He says, you bet your horse is Heine. And which, of course, if you're listening to him on a cruddy radio, you're probably like, yeah, that's clearly Colonel Potter. And then I love when he says, the next time you get a call from Colonel Klinger, Corporal Klinger, collaborate. And just the way he like just leans into that word. When you're talking to him, you're talking to me. It's one of the, you know, they found a way to get some laughs into this episode. And then of course he's like, let's do some trades. You guys get any baklava? That's a great, I love it. I love his impressions of, and in, I think it was in the, not the 30th reunion, I think when they did the 15th reunion, the one where Shelley Long hosted and they had different cast members imitating Harry Morgan. They had Alan Alda doing his, well, you know, Harry just talks like that. And I like that they all had their own Harry Morgan impression. Great. Very distinctive voice, that Harry Morgan. So Winchester comes in and checks in on Hawkeye, and he says, the damned aorta is totally shot. There's no way we can get by without a graft. Winchester's like, oh, that's messy, isn't it? And then Hawkeye says, I'm going to cut the segment away and get ready for a graft. And Winchester's like, well, if you do that, you've committed yourself. What if you don't get a graft? He can't live without an aorta. And then Hawkeye's like, what am I supposed to do? And Winchester says, patch it with one of the arterial grafts. And then we get the line, his aorta is a piece of hamburger. it can't be repaired. Now, again, explain this to the dum-dum over here. How, what is he doing? How can he cut a piece of the aorta out? How is that working? Because then, you know, what do you, how is that possible?
Okay. Okay. Shall I take that, Ange, and then you can chime in? I mean, firstly, amazing that Charles, as a very experienced surgeon, doesn't scrub in and help. But the plot has other needs for him.
Yeah.
So that's my first observation is you could really use another pair of hands, even if it's only to hold a suction tube, because there will be a lot of blood getting in the way. We don't know, I think, is the answer to your question. It depends exactly how mangled it is in there. You have got to somehow create order and structure out of chaos and mess. And so you will have, you know, we don't see it, you know, like you say, maybe the remake in this day and age, you'd see every bit of, you know, tissue, but we don't see it. So all we can assume is that the tube, the integrity of the tube that is the aorta is somehow compromised. It sounds like it's more than just horn. So it sounds like it's disrupted fairly significantly. So what Charles will go on to say, and this is where we start to get into our end-to-end anastomosis chat, is that you've got to have a good bit of piping at one end and a good bit of piping at the other, and then you can attach your graft from our friend Harold in the other room onto those cleanish ends, as clean as you can get them. And so I think the assumption is it's messy, it's mangled, it's friable tissue. Friable is a word we say, just very fragile, and it bleeds very easily if you touch it. It's not in a good place. And so they've got to try and get rid of that. So the clamp is holding the blood in.
Okay.
So, but what's going on below that point is in a really bad state, and Hawkeye has to clean that up, ready to get the graft in place.
Yeah.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
Does that help?
Well described. So the first thing I'll say is I also had in my notes, isn't Charles a vascular surgeon from Mass General Hospital? How are you leaving? Right? Like, come in, dude. Like, this is not an easy surgery. You probably have more experience than I do. This is an audio podcast, I know, but basically, you know, Rob, like,
I gotta tell the
diagram.
Audience,
listeners.
There's a diagram we're looking at right now.
This is the proximal aorta. He has cut it off, so blood is here, and then there's a good part of the aorta, and then there's busted apart part of the aorta, and so he's cutting out this part, and then he is hoping that Roberts is going to give him, or not Roberts, Harold is going to give him this part, and he'll just sew it in. If you think about it like a garden hose, again, think about if you have a garden hose with a bunch of rips, you cut that section out, and then you try to reconnect those.
Okay.
But here you can't. He can't stretch those two pieces together, so he needs a substitute, which is going to come from the other person.
Okay.
If ever Mashcast needed a gallery post, it was today.
Yeah. Exactly right, Rob. You can't live without an aorta. If they can't harvest a graft, at some point he has to undo that clamp, and then this man dies,
yeah.
Right? Because all of his organs distal to that clamp will not get blood. You can't live without your liver, your kidneys, you know, all of those other things.
Yeah.
So the grim reality is if they didn't get a graft, this guy's just going to die. That's it.
Yes.
Right?
That's exactly it. Yes. That is exactly it.
Okay.
If there was one takeaway from this episode, the aorta is vitally important bit of plumbing.
Yeah.
So you really need it. Yeah.
Okay. So Klinger comes in and he says, great news. There's no wounded coming except some baklava. And he says, and Hawkeye's like, how did you get that? And he says, oh, I, you know, it was no problem. Once I explained who I was, and he does the voice and he does it. And Colonel Potter hears that. And he says, you sound like a donkey in heat. And he's like, a post nasal drip, sir. And he's like, oh, okay. So, I could hear more of that of them just doing. So Potter comes in and finally is sort of like getting up to speed of what's going on. And he says, how long has it been clamped? And Hawkeye says, I don't know, 15 or 16 minutes. And he says, make it snappy. A few more minutes, he'll be paralyzed or die of renal failure. And Hawkeye's like, you're telling me. And then he says, give him another unit. And Kelly says, this is our last one, doctor. And Potter says, we have to tap somebody in the camp. What's his blood type? And then they have the discussion of the AB negative. And he says he'd be better off with his own brand. Harry Morgan does this little actor choice right after that, where his face just kind of goes, like his jaw just, and it's a great, it's a thing that you cannot put in a script. You wouldn't think to put in a script. That's an actor who would know, who's so invested in his character. And it just, it's just a kind of folksy, like, that's not ideal. Yeah. You know, he doesn't say it. He doesn't, he just kind of goes, And I just, I love that that tells you so much about what this guy knows of, like, that's, we're not, in, this is not a great situation here.
Potter is a really senior physician. He's been around the block a million times. He knows how bad this is. He knows that there is, like, I mean, Angie's description of this is miracle surgery. You ain't wrong. You know, this is a one in a million shot that this goes right, and he knows it. And that's what that is the, you know, I've seen this go badly wrong so too many times, I can tell you, you know?
Yeah, you're 16 minutes into what we hope is 20 minutes, and we don't even have the right blood type for this guy, right?
Yeah.
Things are not stacking well here, right? Okay. You know?
So then they reveal that Winchester has the proper blood type, and they say, well, when did you give? And he says, oh, just 5 days ago. And there's a great little gag where Potter goes, 5 days ago, I've got enough dizzy surgeons around here. And he kind of gestures to Hawkeye, which I think is like a fun little gag. Okay. Now, this is where MASH's abject refusal to have any continuity in its episodes is frustrating, because it has been established just last season in the cave that Klinger, Winchester, and Mulcahy all have the same blood type. So if Winchester has the necessary blood type, you can get it from Klinger and Mulcahy, but they don't bother with that.
Klinger's too busy getting baklava, you know? He's got other things to do.
I guess so. I mean, Klinger has the line, you know, I have the same blood type as Winchester and Mulcahy, except one's a little purer and one's a little bluer. So they have the line, and then Winchester says, no, we've all, my family's always given blood during times of crisis, darting back to the Revolutionary War, which gets Hawkeye says, they gave to both sides, which is great. great little gag. So Potter's like, all right, okay, you know, give him fluids. I don't want his volume to get too low. This scene was cut in syndication, where they have this kind of back and forth a little bit about, be gentle with me, says to the nurse. Again, the editors of this one really did in Philadelphia did a great job of cutting out cutting it down to the bare bones of just leaving the chunk of the episode. So we're down in the pre-op, and they've brought Roberts in. We see Mulcahy working, like he's got some implement. Can you guys tell what that was? It's some sort of, he's like winding something. Is that like a chest, like a rib spreader or something?
Rib spreader, basically, like open up the chest so that BJ can get to this guy's aorta.
Okay. So Roberts comes in and he's not giving BJ any rope. He's like, he just, what do you mean? And then BJ says, you know, what do you mean? What good? And then Klinger does something I don't think Klinger would ever do. I think he's been here long enough to know you don't have this kind of conversation in front of someone else whom you don't know. And BJ's like, all right, I got it. Get out of here. Get lost, Klinger. And then Klinger says, okay, but Hawkeye wants to know as soon as he's dead, which sounds horrible, right? Of course, to Roberts, that sounds, and Klinger would never say that. It's a little sloppy.
We could have a whole conversation about patient confidentiality in MASH, I think. however, I'll slightly defend Klinger in that I think in the heat of the moment,
this very heightened situation,
time is of the essence. It's not good. It's not right. But I can see how it happened.
I can totally see how it happens in times of high stress. That membrane of what you should say becomes more permeable and more stuff can sort of sneak out, right? Like Hawkeye is on like the edge of his seat and I can see Hawkeye is stressed. And so I'm just going to try to convey that in a way that's inappropriate.
Yeah.
And he knows it immediately because he says, I'm sorry if I said something that I shouldn't have, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And he kind of like flops his arms and walks away dejected because he knows that he said the wrong thing. So, yeah, again, in any other situation, Klinger would not say that. But again, everybody's super heightened on this thing. So, okay. So Roberts keeps giving BJ grief and he says, you know, he's just a piece of meat to you. And then BJ finally doesn't lose his temper, but he finally is sort of like, look, I got to stop kind of coddling this guy a little bit. And he says, you got to understand most of your friend's brain is gone. He stopped being Harold Sherwood when that shell hit him in the head. He's been dead for half an hour. His heart just didn't know enough to stop beating. And, you know, we're wading into some theological thickets here because, you know, okay. Some people would say the brain is the thing that makes you who you are. And other people would say, you know, the soul, you know, for lack of a better word, is the thing that makes you who you are. And some people would argue, no, this guy is still Harold Sherwood because he's still got electricity flowing through him and his heart is beating. But of course, in this moment, BJ doesn't, you know, have time for these sort of niceties. And then, you know, Mulcahy says, you know, his pulse is very, very thready. And, BJ takes it and they realize, okay, this guy is, you know, he's within moments of dying. And then Robert says, can you take me over there? And I kind of like that BJ is Roberts, please. Like he's kind of like, okay, already. I understand. But, you know, but even then he still lets him do it, which seems inadvisable, right? Because of the time pressure, like you're giving Roberts even 10 seconds. I don't know. Am I being heartless here? Again, no pun intended.
I'll go first. The first thing I'll say is, you know, higher function is gone here. It's Harold's midbrain, right? The most primitive part of your brain that is still functioning. If he is showing these signs, there's no thinking or thought. All right. So you could say he is no longer Harold, right? So I think that it's blunt, but I think that, as you say, he's been sort of pressured along and BJ's feeling some stress. I will say the actor who does Harold does what we call agonal breathing in an incredible acting job. If you thought the moans before, the disorganized and dysfunctional breathing that he does that lets them know he is near the end is spot on here. I don't know if anybody was on the set to basically say, like, this is what it looks like, but that's certainly what it sounds like. And I do think, Rob, you know, it's not heartless because if you think about, like, cancer patients in hospice where you have the loved one, like, do you want to hold their hand as they're passing because it's going to be in the next few seconds? I think is something that we try to do to sort of, like, help assuage those people dealing with their grief. Now, you're going to strip him naked and spread his chest and get his aorta moments thereafter. I don't know if I would say like, oh, I'm going to let you linger here for 5 minutes. No, this is like, say your bit, say goodbye to your friend. You have to go to the OR too. You've got a belly wound that we have to sort of deal with. Mm-hmm. I don't think it was too heartless. I'm going to say it gave some closure, right? He says, there's a picture in his pocket of us. Can you give it to me? I think it was nice. As long as you don't let it go too far. Like at some point you would have to just be like, I'm extricating you. You've got 5 seconds left.
Yeah. End of life. I mean, you've got MASHCAST has 2 attending doctors. I think you maybe need an attending priest to come on and guest on this episode because boy, I think there's a lot you could do on, you could rerun this episode with a priest and get a whole other conversation. Mm-hmm. I think BJ is the only one of the surgeons that has this conversation with Roberts. I think if it's Hawkeye or it's Winchester, they just go, get this guy out of here. You know,
definitely BJ is the one that Winchester says, would not have any time for this.
BJ says, this is a pain. This is making my life harder. Time is critical. You are wasting time. But I'm going to let you do it anyway. And I think he's got a holistic thing. I mean, goodness knows what's Robert see. You know, PTSD was probably not a thing in the Korean War, but it sure is now. And if you can go some way to alleviating that moment, then that is years of therapy for Roberts you've just saved. You know, if you can give him a moment to say goodbye, do it respectfully. He wants the photo, give him the photo. That is good care of Roberts just as much as they've taken their time over his belly wound, by the way, haven't they? I'm a bit worried about how long he's been sitting with that. But, they're looking at, and we will see a scene with Mulcahy in a bit where he just, there is continued rehabilitation for Roberts's bereavement that is just lovely to see. So, yeah, I think, yes, it's difficult from Hawkeye's point of view, but it's important from Roberts's point of view.
Okay. So Hawkeye, Winchester talk, we're back in the OR and Winchester says, I saw this operation once, and he's kind of giving Hawkeye sort of instructions as he's laying there on the table. And then Hawkeye cuts the piece away and he's basically like committed now. He's like, now I just got to wait. Now we realize they are playing with, it's not that this scene is taking place out, the scene with BJ is taking place, then the Hawkeye scene in order. It could be they're happening simultaneously. You know, that's what's going on. So while Hawkeye is cutting away the piece of the hamburger, that's when Roberts is getting the photo. So it's actually not like Hawkeye's just standing there going, Beach, when are you getting this done? You know, it could be that kind of thing. So.
And you see BJ run in with the tissue, don't the minute, I mean literally the minute, the second he's got it, he runs in. And Charles does a description of how to perform end-to-end anastomosis on
There you
a
go.
1980 sitcom. So there we go.
Now, just before we get to that, though, there is a bit of like mechanics that I appreciate because I have been hearing on MASH my whole life retraction, that term, and I've never known what retraction meant. I can sort of understand, but I guess it means open up the space a little more. But I've never known what it meant, right? Well, okay, we know here that they've got the rib spreader. And then when he says to the nurse, I think I forget the name of this, I think Gwen maybe, he says more retraction. And you see her go, make a little circle motion. And I'm like, oh, that's the rib spreader. And she's cranking it and it's presumably opening the chest a little bit further. So now, right? That's what retraction is.
Yes, I mean that's mechanical retraction with the rib spreader. I mean, as a junior doctor, the hours I spent holding back somebody's liver for my consultant surgeon to do his magic, livers are heavy. It's a good way of building up the strength in your left arm, I have to say. It's just pulling it back so you've got a clear surgical field, is what we call
Okay.
it. So that you've got a lot of space to, you can see what you're doing. You've got space to do whatever you need to do. So yeah, it's an important part, but boy, is it boring.
Like think about it, Rob. The ribs are open. The lung is draped over the aorta. You have to retract the lung out of the way so that he can get to the aorta and take the piece that he needs. And you're right, Chris, in medical school, when you're the medical student on surgery, it's like retract this bowel. Literally, you're just holding guts apart for 4 hours. And then sometimes you get, I've been holding it so long, my arms are getting weak. And they go, oh, okay, get the device. And then they get like something. It's like, why have I been holding this? If you had something that you could just hold it out of the way, rite of passage, right? That's all it is.
You know you've made it when they trust you to hold the suction tube. That's when you've made it.
So
They consider you potential surgical material at
now
that
BJ asks when BJ is getting ready to get the graft, he asks Gwen for smooth pickups. Can one of you guys explain what a smooth because they mean they that's obviously they could have just said anything. He or she could have just handed him something and, but they obviously take the time to mention smooth pickups. So what are smooth pickups?
Well, there are a variety of pickups are basically tweezers if you think about them like grossly, and then there are a variety of different types. There's toothed, right, pickups. So like if you use those, you're going to poke a hole in the graft material that you just grabbed, right? And
There
then
we
there's
go.
smooth
Okay.
pickups, and then there's serrated pickups. There's all sorts of different pickups. And
Okay.
oh, by the way, I just have to say the piece that we see him pull out is so small. It is like a shoelace. I just don't even understand. Like we've heard is we need a big piece, and it's
It's
this
not
big.
even
You can hold
rigatoni.
It's both skinny and short, and we know that's bad in every area of life. So,
but I suppose to like people who aren't looking for that type of verisimilitude, it's like, oh, they got a piece of tissue in a ray. But I hit pause, and I was like, I don't know.
stretching to me. This aorta is going to be on so much tension.
So, So they put the piece
He's
in
not gonna be able
there.
to bend over, you know.
They put the piece in there. BJ goes running in. They're like, all right, put some gloves on. He says, rinse the graft in heparin. What is that? What is heparin? Is that just a.
Blood thinner,
Okay.
yeah,
so it's to stop
not
clots, presumably. Okay.
clots from happening. So yeah.
There's a really great line where Hawkeye says, "What took so long?" And BJ says, "The guy that was using it was still attached to the guy using it."
Yeah.
And Hawkeye pauses and realizes, "Okay, yeah, there's you know
Yeah.
you you're having your home you're having your own story out
Yeah.
there while I'm
Yeah.
doing this." So, okay, now we're getting to the quote unquote meat of the episode. First, Winchester explains to the audience, first you complete the upper anastomosis. So which one of you guys wants to go? What is an anastomosis?
Do you want to take it, or shall I?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, end-to-end anastomosis. So anastomosis is joining something, a tube structure, to two ends of another tube structure. So we've said that the aorta is basically plumbing, okay? So what you need to do is you need to join one open end. Oh, there are more diagrams, folks, by the
Thanks,
way.
Ange. Thanks, Ange.
And I knew that I could see Ange drawing. I knew there was a diagram coming. You've got two ends of a tube, which is George's aorta. And what we want to do is get the graft from Harold in. So we need to stitch the open end, the top end of George's aorta to one end of the graft. And it's done. Oh, that's beautiful. That's like Frankenstein, Ange. We need these diagrams up. And then you join the lower end together. And so the idea is that you're basically trying to restore function and flow through the tube. So in this case, it's blood vessels and blood. It could be intestines and poo. And so you have two clean cut ends bring together, and then you would stitch them, suture them together. These days you might staple them together, but I don't think that was the technology that they had. Winchester says, I'd like you to do mattress stitching, which is very secure, but takes a long time. How's your mattress stitching? I can't remember the last time I did it. So it's very, and Hawkeye says, we don't have time to make it pretty. We are just going to make it functional, quite rightly. So we can go back and do the what do they call it? Nifty knitting. We can go back and do that later. But so that's what you're doing, is basically to try and do that. And Angie's diagrams will be available on his
Yes, that's
website.
exactly. Like, I do vertical and horizontal mattresses on like skin lacerations in the emergency department that are under a lot of tension, but they do take a long time. They're longer than a running stitch or simple stitches. And I think to Hawkeye's credit, it's like we're probably nearing 20 minutes. I'm just going to sew this as fast as I can with the simplest stitch that I can just to get this inside. And he says later, I'll make it neat later, right? We can come back to this at a different time, but we just got to get the plumbing going again.
Okay. So then Hawkeye and BJ have a little conversation about Harold, and Hawkeye's like, "Who's Harold?" He's like, "It's the guy and who gave us this." And Hawkeye's like, "Harold, meet George, meet Harold. Harold, meet George." And so they're working on that. And then we're back out in pre-op and with Mulcahy talking to Roberts, and Roberts is, you know, he's kind of horrified at all what he's seeing, and he's sort of regarding the doctors as these sort of ghouls. And Mulcahy's trying to, you know, trying to talk him down, and he says, you know, he was such a nice guy. That's why we called him Harold. We tried calling him Harry, but it didn't seem to fit. And Mulcahy manages to, you know, he says, it's such a terrible waste, isn't it? And you know, he's like, yeah, he was the best guy in the outfit, father. And then Mulcahy delivers, you know, again, for an episode not about Father Mulcahy. Boy, does William Christopher get a couple of really great speeches here. And then he finally says, son, let me ask you something. Harold sounds like the kind of man that gave of himself. He would have thrown himself on a grenade to save somebody else. And then Robert says, sure, he wouldn't have even thought about it. And then Mulcahy says, well, even if he didn't know the other person. And he's, yeah. And he says, well, that's what he's doing now. And it's like, wow. You know, like, I, you know, t talk about, you know, that's like psychiatrist level medicine in terms of being able to soothe your patient in this instance. It's absolutely a marvelous speech from Alan Alda, I guess, who wrote that.
In my notes, I put Mulcahy is doing emotional life-saving with Roberts. This counseling is as important as the surgery. And I think what I like is that he gets to know what Harold meant to Roberts and uses Roberts' experience of his friend to say, that's what's happening now. And he can meet Roberts where he is and say, the way he is acting in death is exactly the way he would have acted in life. And it helps him to come to terms with the death because he sees his friend is being consistent to his values. I think like you say, I mean, so nicely acted. It's terrific.
Really a marvelous speech. It's always fun to me when I rewatch these for the purposes of the show. And I think of certain episodes and when I think of this one, I'm like, oh, that's a real doc, it's a real Hawkeye episode. And then you watch it like, yeah, but wow, man, Mulcahy gets some killer. Nope. I shouldn't use that phrase. He gets some really, sorry. He gets some really potent speeches.
Yeah.
For an episode not about him. This is fantastic. So now we're back in the OR and Winchester is talking about don't handle the graft. Because he's slowly dozing off from giving and then he's like, finally, there's one thing very important, and then he passes out and they're like, okay, fine. So Potter comes in and he says, what happened to him? And he says, oh, he gave his all. So and then Potter says, well, some people get to all faster than others. So they
good
bring
line. I like that.
Yeah, they bring in Roberts. I know you've mentioned this, Chris, that like, oh, he's got a belly wound. They do say that, but it's clearly pretty minor. I think they even say it's a minor belly wound. I don't know. Wouldn't you wait maybe for Harold's thing to be done I don't know. Maybe not.
Well, I don't think there's, I don't know what a real MASH was like, but there's not many operating theaters where you have, one patient in sight of another being operated on, far as I'm aware. So, it's done for dramatic purpose. So you can get the banter between the surgeons and the staff. Yeah. And I was going to say, actually, that banter, that sort of, slightly Marx Brothers-ish talking about the vocabulary thing, that's absolutely typical of what does happen in operating theatres. That sort of slightly black humour and that, the teams often work together. So you really do get some very strange, often very humorous conversations going on across a patient that's being operated on. So that's very true. But yeah, I mean, it's nice because it's another moment of closure. Roberts and BJ have been at loggerheads all the time. Roberts has kind of come to terms with things thanks to Mulcahy. And now you get a little bit of BJ and Roberts being conciliatory and on the same side and talking about things. And I think it's a great idea if you meet our patient, assuming he survives, to tell him about the donor. All of that is a very nice, it brings that part of the story together very nicely. But you don't get it if they're in operating theatres at distant ends of the camp. So again, it's a compromise for the story, isn't it?
I mean, I would think that he probably would have gotten a little bit of a sedative outside before he gets wheeled into the OR, or there would be some type of sheet up, right?
Because they don't put up a privacy screen. They do that.
Yeah, Potter calls for a screen, doesn't he?
Blood and guts and sort of that sort of things. But I do think for the plot, to have Roberts say, I would like to meet him and tell him about Harold, is that closure that I think is sort of needed. So I'll allow it, I guess, is probably the best thing.
Also, it's probably been established that Roberts has calmed down. I think Mulcahy is probably like, yeah, he's okay now. He wasn't, he's not ranting and raving the way he was 10 minutes ago. And so they're like, okay, it's fine. But I do think about that sometimes. We're like, the last time I was in a hospital when I got my colonoscopy for the first time. And like, there was a patient on the other side of the wall and I heard he was talking very loudly and I learned all about his medical conditions, because he was talking kind of like this and I'm like, all right, I don't need to know all this, This is like, okay, but I know, what are you going to do? He can't, you're going to We're all in the same space. So then we get into the nitty gritty of the surgery. They put it on, and then you literally see blood shooting up into the thing and into the air and yelling, pack it, pack it. And he puts some suction on, and Kelly's like, his pressure's going down. Put the blood in faster. Put the clamp back on. Hawkeye says, I don't want to stop circulation again. And then BJ says, can you sew it while it's bleeding? Give me a needle. And take the sponges off, and then you see the blood shooting off. Take it all the way off, and it's shooting up. Now, it sounds pretty tough, right? Trying to sew something while it's bleeding? That sounds pretty tough.
Listeners, I think Dan's is drawing another diagram. Yeah, I mean, hats off to the practical effect guys. I love the fact that there was a special effects man with a little rubber bulb on
the guy under the table.
He does good squirts. There are good spurts of arterial blood. It maybe could have been a bit redder, but, you know, whatever. Yeah, I mean, suturing is a good way of stopping bleeding. So that is completely legit. Yes, there. I would expect there to be leakage given the mess it's been. So I, you know, to have done it perfectly first time under those circumstances, yeah, there's going to be blood leaking, and they are going to want to pack it, and they're going to want to pour more blood in, and they're going to want to, you know, pad it up so they can see the, again, the surgical field. So some clarity, you can't sew what you can't see. And so to get the blood out of the way is really important. But yeah, to be going in and going, I need to do more suturing. Yeah, totally legit.
Totally makes sense to me. And I think that it is, you're just trying to find the right spot to throw the right stitch. So between packing and seeing where it's coming from, and then hold suction right there, and I'm going to try to throw a stitch in around that spot to sort of oversew that area, I think makes good sense. Again, sorry, but like, it's like, you can see like, oh, there was a gap there that I wasn't expecting. And so like blood is squirting out. Remember, the aorta is a big tube and we only see a thin stream. It's like, oh, and then he says like, oh, I'm going to put in two stitches there to sort of overtie. I think that makes, that totally makes sense. Totally makes sense.
We could monetize this episode as how to do your own vascular surgery now, couldn't we? This is one of those courses you see online.
I'm pretty sure RFK Jr. thinks he knows how to do this. You know, I don't know if you guys saw, there was that story a couple of, by the time people were hearing this months ago, that when they remastered Mad Men for HBO Max, they messed up and they put in more of the frame than you're supposed to see. And there's an episode with John Slattery where he throws up in the office. And while you're watching the episode, you see the throw up pump guy on the right-hand side of the screen with his pump going, and you're not, and it's, they just cropped it wrong. And while I would never want that for MASH, I would kill to see the guy who's on here with the pump going, as he's doing the thing. And by the way, I also say the scene is very well edited of the quick cuts to everybody. And everyone's telling Hawkeye, giving him a suggestion. And he's having to filter through all that. You know, she's like, put the clamp back on, pump more blood in, do this. And it's like in split second, you've got to figure out the right thing to do. It's well done.
Well, and everybody's right. Everybody's right. But he's... they're saying do three things simultaneously. You know, and you're right. It's another good moment of tension because it's the critical moment at the end of that operation to go, this is everything it's built up to. All of what's happened in the last 20 whatever minutes is at this moment. And it doesn't go perfect. It is. And that's real. So, you know, to make it right, you still, you know, it's not, you know, the taking the clamp off is the moment of truth. And actually, you've still got more to do. So it's great.
Yeah.
I love the fact that, you know, again, in those situations, you want to hear what could happen, but then you have to decide. And I agree with Hawkeye that to like reclamp, where it turns out we're over 20 minutes, right? Yeah. I would rather have the blood running so I know where I'm supposed to sew. Can you imagine clamping? I think I know the spot. Unclamping, no, that was not the right spot. So I think he makes the right decision here.
Okay. Yes.
And then BJ even says that's some nifty knitting, which again is probably, you know, like a nice way to remind, like, hey, this is why Hawkeye is Hawkeye, right? Because he is cool under pressure and can do this kind of stuff. And then they shake hands, pour in the antibiotics, and then Kelly time. And she says it's 2:55 and 25 seconds. And in Hawkeye's. We're 3.5 minutes over, damn it. Maybe the hypothermia bought us some time. Yeah, but maybe it didn't. So, okay, is that 3.5? Is that that's that big of a deal? Or is that egregiously over kind of thing?
Well, we started by saying we'd feel a bit nervous about something
even
being
20 minutes,
short of
right.
blood for 20 yeah. minutes. And plus the chopper ride, who knows how long that is. But did the cold buy us time? Yeah, it probably did. Because like we said, you know, as we know, we can transport organs in ice across continents. It buys you significant amounts of time. So their judgment, although we'll take the timing as read for the purposes of the show, but the cold probably was the thing that bought them the most time.
Yeah, and I'll say, remember, Rob, that these are not, it's not as if, like, we know that at exactly 20 minutes
sure.
to become paralyzed, right?
Yeah.
Because there are
yeah.
probably people that have been clamped for 17 minutes that are paralyzed, and there are people that may have been clamped for 28 minutes yeah. that aren't. We just know this yeah. is the time that we yeah. should be aiming for, right? So,
yeah.
like, there are
yeah.
all of these time-sensitive things. And so you say, like, 3.5 minutes, dang, we're over. That's not the best shot.
Yeah.
But it's not as if you're 20 minutes over, right? So,
yeah.
so I think that his response of, like, damn.
Yes.
I think is like a little bit dramatic. Like maybe to be like, you know, I might have yeah. gone like crap under my breath.
Yeah.
Well, he's Hawkeye.
He's Hawkeye, right? He's a perfectionist.
The appropriate reflection is maybe I don't keep the clamps under my porno mags next time.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that might buy me
now,
the 3 minutes.
The Journal of Competitive Nudity sounds like a medical magazine or something. Come on, Chris. We don't know.
I believe that's how they were sold back in the day. Well,
that is exactly how they were sold.
Something
yes.
like that. Yeah.
I think they were called like lifestyle magazines or naturalist
yes, yes.
magazines or
yes.
something like that.
Yeah.
So anyway, that's the end of our chunk of the episode, and we get the ticking clock again. We don't get it when it comes back into commercial because now we're in post-op and they're talking to Winchester and, you know, because he's woozy from and he wants to do his rounds. And Hawkeye's like, I'll do it. And Charles is like, no, I'll do it. I don't take charity. And Hawkeye's like, you know, you just gave some blood. And he's like, oh, I'll get to them in 30 or 40 minutes. And he passes back out. So, okay. So then we see Margaret is with the patient and he's starting to wake up. And I was, for the long time, I was wondering, who is this guy? Who is the guy? Who is George? And we finally get a shot of his face. And I see that it is Bill Snyder. Bill Snyder was one of the corpsmen on MASH. This is his first appearance. He would not get credited until season 9, but he would appear in various episodes of the show. And he gets a little line of dialogue in the finale where he talks about what he's going to go do. But obviously they could just figure they could, yeah, nobody's going to pay attention. So that's who it is. This is Bill Snyder sitting here. By the way, if Ryan Daly is listening, I know he's not, but in case he is, he was on 7 episodes of Cheers as well. So Bill Snyder's done all right for himself. So
I'm hoping George got discharged after this injury. I don't see George carrying on a military
no,
career, frankly,
sure.
after
this
surgery.
So they uncover.
Don't think he'll be fit for service.
They uncover his feet and they start slapping him. Wake up! And he's like, wiggle your toes, and they're slapping. And then BJ is running his like a pencil underneath, and we see that the feet start to move. So okay, you guys are laughing. So what is it?
Can we let
this?
The pediatrician talk about the Babinski reflex, please?
Yeah, right. This is what they call the Babinski reflex. It's actually something. So you rub the bottom of the foot,
sure,
and there is a reflex that your toes, instead of retracting from that noxious stimuli, go towards it. And so him doing that is literally saying like, I want to see if his nervous system is intact. This is an unconscious reflex that will happen if I do that.
Okay.
No response. but we'll gloss over that. Because then he moves his foot on his own, right?
Well, so, at least they went up going, because that would have been hard to fake. You know?
Yes, that would have been hard to fake.
So it's medically sound.
It's not. Yeah. It's a nice little thing for them to do for the people that recognize what he's trying to do. It could just be trying to tickle him to sort of see like if he responds from the tickle. But it's a true maneuver that we use.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, if you want to be strictly accurate, you go back and they do half hourly neuro obs, and they chart and see what's going on. And you know, the worry after that time would be he might have a reflex now, but what about in 6 hours' time? You know, if that spinal cord's had injury, it might be that the nerves are slowly dying. So, you know, you would want to keep an eye on this man for quite a long time afterwards. Yeah, it's a thing. It's a legit thing.
Okay, all right. And so there's a moment of silence, and then they all scream in joy, and Hawkeye and BJ and Margaret embrace each other. And she's like, we did it, you know what we did. And BJ says, we meet a guy who's part George and part Harold. And then Winchester says, and part Winchester. That's right. When he wakes up, he won't know whether to be brave, generous, or pompous. And that is the end of our episode, Lifetime, a true humdinger of a show. By the way, I was curious, did Dr. Deschelles go on to write any other episode? I know he never wrote another MASH, but I was like, did he parlay this into other TV gigs? And he only has one other he only has one other credit. He wrote or co-wrote an episode of House Calls, another medical show with Wayne Rogers, by the way, another MASH connection. The title of that episode, which shows you maybe how MASH was a little higher class than some other shows, the title of that episode is The Sex Police. So,
Oh, okay. Are we getting called back for that one?
Doctor, until when I start House Calls cast, I will put in a call to you guys. But yes, Dr. Walter Deschelles, two credits, Lifetime and The Sex Police. So make of that.
I looked him up on IMDb. He was a plastic surgeon and a
Oh,
what
really?
I
Oh, I
call
didn't know
an
that.
ENT surgeon.
Okay.
Apparently, he got the call. He was a medical advisor on a number of shows. He got the call because he was a Hollywood plastic surgeon. So, funnily enough, some of his clients might have
Oh,
had connections.
I
And
see.
yeah, I think he was making plenty of money being a plastic surgeon, Rob. I don't think TV was necessarily the main string to his bow.
Okay.
Yeah,
All right.
he's got a Wikipedia page, and they say that
He's
one of the things for MASH, it was to make sure that they weren't doing medicine that was too modern. And so he would actually like look at stuff in the 50s and say, like, would this be around then? So
great
he's still
episode.
alive, apparently.
Is he still
He's still
alive? Oh, good
alive.
for him. That's fantastic.
Wikipedia says he's 86.
Good
So
for him. It
good
sounds
on
like a
you.
sweet.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor, for this episode. We loved it.
Sure. We
It
should
sounds
seek
like
him out.
a sweet gig, right? Like you just consult on a hugely popular television show. You get your name in the credits every week. Like, you know, I mean, obviously a lot harder to do back then because you couldn't just Wikipedia everything, but still, you know, I'm like, that sounds like a really sweet gig of like, hey, do you want to consult on MASH every week? Yeah. Well, boy, do I, you know?
Ange and I are available,
Yeah, I was
you
going to
know,
say Hollywood. Start
accepting
phone numbers.
offers.
Hey, producers of the Pit, are you guys listening? These guys are available. So, okay, all right, well, Chris, let me start with you. Do you have a favorite line? But not a lot of jokes in this episode, so it doesn't have to be a joke, but do you have a favorite line or joke from the episode?
You always ask this, Robert. I was trying to think, and I watch my shows on Apple TV, and the description, the listing on Apple TV for this show is Hawkeye has 20 minutes to save a critically wounded soldier, which is not wrong, but
Right.
it totally misses the point for me because although Hawkeye is the one holding the scalpel, you need every single member of the unit to save George. You know, the one thing about having a clock on the screen is we can say Hawkeye was immobilized for 7 minutes out of the critical 20, and everyone is working around him. So I don't think this is an episode that you can really dissect. I think it's a symphony, and every bit of the story, every character's contribution is completely essential. And that's true for, you know, I mean, we've talked about medical dramas. Two medical dramas rely on either characters illicitly falling in love and snogging in the sluice room or looking daggers at each other. And actually, real working life is not like that. Everybody is a team. And this is a team effort surgically. And I think for the drama, it is a true ensemble cast. And my hot take on this is every character is kind of the platonic ideal of themselves. Hawkeye is the brilliant, wisecracking surgeon. BJ is the emotionally sensitive doctor. Charles is pompous but infuriatingly always right. Margaret is the perfect nurse. You know, Mulcahy is the perfect priest. The one character I think didn't get maybe quite so much time as Potter. I would have liked seeing a little bit more
Yeah,
of him.
he's not in it very much at
But
all, yeah.
no, but I think so. For me, the big thing about this is the teamwork, not just as the drama, but as the surgery. And I think that's the standout thing for me is how, 8 seasons in, they show this team at the top of its game, just working, pulling off what is, your description again, Alex, miracle surgery. I think that for me is the standout of this episode. So it's not down to a line, it's not down to a scene. I can't pull it apart. It's just a really perfect episode of MASH.
Yeah.
I
Ange?
mean, I will say I agree with all of that. And I have to say, having been in situations that are extremely dicey, where everything goes according to plan in some sort of way, for me, stabilizing a patient to get them either to an intensive care unit or an ICU or an OR, like that sort of team play here, I think was great. I will say, I do have a favorite set of lines. When Margaret says they're in alcohol, and Hawkeye says, "I've had my unsterilized hand in this man's chest for the last 15 minutes," and she goes, "What type of nurse do you think I am?" That struck so true, that I was like, "That is clearly my interaction." It would have been very easy to say, "You sound like a donkey in heat." That's the laugh line, but that interaction between doctor and nurse is perfection So,
Rob, can we ask, do you have a favorite surgical procedure at all?
well, Rob, what stuck out for you for this? We never turn it around.
I mean, the viscera of they really are able to sell the pump sewing while it's bleeding. I resonated with, when I was a kid, I was like, wow, that does sound really tough. And it's that's what makes Hawkeye Hawkeye, right? Because they all the doctors have their own, they're all equally good doctors, right? But they all have a specialty that they're a little bit better than the other ones are, right? I would argue they're all virtually the same in terms of pure surgical skill. Winchester is maybe a little bit better at that. He's got more experience, so he's got the edge there. Potter is more of a holistic thinking big picture because he's the commander. Hawkeye is pure surgical skill. And I think BJ is, as you guys were talking about, with patience. Like better at that kind of thing. So they all have, but this is, Hawkeye is always the first among equals on this show, but that is really like, yeah, that's how good this guy is. He can sew a piece of aorta while the blood is pumping through it, and he can keep his hand steady, keep his nerves steady, and he has a good enough eye that he can, and even BJ is like impressed by that. It's an amazing episode. Now, my favorite interaction is the bit between him and Kelly, where she shows the graphs and he's like, these are too small. Well, this one's pretty big. And then he goes, no, that's no bigger than a piece of spaghettini. We need rigatoni. Now, first of all, spaghettini is like a spaghetti. Doesn't have a hole in it. So that doesn't even make any sense. And as you pointed out, and rigatoni wouldn't even be big enough. But I like where she's like, rigatoni, doctor, I'm part Chinese and part Hawaiian. Can you put that in ethnic measurements? I can understand a small egg roll. That I understand. We don't have any that big. I just think that's a funny interaction. And I like that Nurse Kelly got that much to do, So I like all that. I just like that she's like, I don't know what rigatoni is. What, talk to me in language I can understand. An egg roll. Okay. Yeah, that I understand. So that's good stuff. This is a classic episode. This is just one of their late period winners. I'm glad they never tried it again. I think they got it right on the first, they could have kept trying this. They didn't. They got it right. They got it right on the first one. It all the I guess you said, Chris, other than Potter, everyone gets something really good to do, really solid. This is just a classic episode, and it shows that even 8 seasons in, they were still trying. They were still trying to do different things, and they managed to, forgive this word I'm about to use, crafted the war stuff onto it. It's not just a med, because you could do the medical case on Trapper John MD if you wanted to, right? But no, they've got the, we got to worry about blood, and we've got to worry about, and they never forget that, well, what's the context that all this is happening in, that this guy is sacrificed, that kind of thing. So it's just a winner of an episode, and as I said at the top, back when in season six, when we first did this, an episode with the three of you, I was like, oh man, I can't wait to get to Lifetime. So we did it, everybody. Guys, thank you so much. We are clocking in at 2 hours, which is actually a little under than I thought it was going to be. I thought we would actually go. So you guys kept it pretty tight.
Is this the longest episode?
Wait, what? I'm sorry, Chris. What did you say?
I said, is this your longest MASH episode?
There's actually, I've recorded one earlier this season that's actually a little bit longer, okay. Only by a couple of minutes. So if we keep talking, we can get to it. Ange,
I was going to say, we've been talking for 2 hours. Our listeners are paralyzed right yeah. now. This is ridiculous.
Them off too long. Or in renal failure.
This is why you should be doing other things while you're listening to a podcast. Don't just sit and listen to it and stare off in the middle distance. So,
Consume fluids.
Yeah, exactly. Keep the fluids going. So, guys, is there anything else you want to say about this episode before we sign off? Any other final comments, either one you want to have about it?
Thanks for inviting us. It's great.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us. I always have a great time talking with the two of you guys. Thank you very much, Rob. I'm glad that
I love doing these shows with you guys, and I love bringing the medical knowledge. This is fascinating to me for someone that watched the show for so long, and I just kind of squinted some of this. I guess that's okay, you know, whatever. But this is just such a great episode. It's, to me, it's just like such a peak in season eight, which had a lot of peaks in it. So again, thank you both very much. You guys are like the Sidney Friedman of this show. You come back once a year and I'm really looking forward to it, and you come back and we do this. So we'll have to find whatever the big medical case is for season nine. So thank you all for listening. I hope you learned something. I think this episode probably counts towards your medical training. If any of you out there want to become doctors, this, you could just listen to this one and say, hey, I already know a lot about anastomosis because I learned it from these guys. So again, thank you all for listening. Of course, you can find all the back episodes on our website, findwaterpodcast.com. You can find me on Blue Sky under Rob Kelly Creative. And if you want to support the Fine Water Podcast Network, of which MASHcast is a part, please go to patreon.com/FW podcast. And there you can unlock various rewards, one of which is to be name checked on a show of your choice. So big salute to Dennis Bailey, Darrell Clark, James K, Michael Kelly, David Mann, Matt McLean, Lisa P, Brady Palmer, Joe Perino, Stan Peel, Michael Porter, Nicholas Prom, Adam Sanders, Stefan Van Schaik, Britt Schramm, Billy Schulman, and Mike Thomas. So that is going to do it. Thanks, everybody, for listening. We will see you next week with a shorter episode. But until then, that is all.